welcome to another episode of Double Crossed Radio. I am your host, Drew Lamb, and tonight I am joined by my co-host, Chuck Horton, and a new member of our team, Colby Olson. Our guest tonight is author and historian Fritz Springmeier. Mr. Springmeier has written over a dozen books, including Bloodlines of the Illuminati. You can purchase his books at pentrax.com. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me tonight. Chuck, welcome back. You've been in Ecuador.
Yes, it's good to be back. I should have been back last week, but I'm embarrassed to say I was so exhausted after being up for 36 straight hours. I fell asleep about 3 in the afternoon. I slept right through the show.
So I can't believe that you aren't on a list or something. You know, they actually let you get on an airplane.
Yeah, actually, I got when they marked my ticket, I looked at it, and they had a special designation. I was marked preferred security or something, so I didn't have to take my shoes off even.
Wow. Huh.
And I think that's because prior to that, I went to Alaska, I borrowed your Geiger counter.
Yeah.
And I told him I was a journalist and gave him my Double Cross Radio card. And I may be in a new database now where I'm a journalist. That might be working for me. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I'm glad you made it back. And you'll give us an update next week on your trip?
Yeah, I'll give you the travel log, our adventures in Ecuador, which were quite pleasant. I liked it very much.
Oh, that's good to hear. Fritz, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
What an honor to be back. I've always enjoyed our shows.
I think this is 5 or 6 times. I'm losing count.
I just got through visiting with a young gentleman from Chile. It's kind of a coincidence. And so, of course, I picked his mind as to what's going on. And Chile's doing really good economically. He works for the airline. Their infrastructure, the country's improving, and so forth. So, it all sounded pretty good. And, you know, when you mentioned about the Chilean airline, that was who he worked for. So,
it's a fabulous airline.
Yeah,
it is so much better run than United. You can't believe it. it's like, whoa, this is how it could be here in America. But it's from the flight attendants to the people at the gate to everything about it is just about as good as you could imagine.
That's great.
I've had a lot of bad experiences flying. I think it was the second time I flew on a plane. I was leaving Bangkok, Thailand, heading to Tokyo, and we had a problem with the landing gear, and we thought we were going to have to crash land in Tokyo. And we had a near miss on another flight heading into San Francisco, and that was about 20 years ago, and had another situation where we spent about 4 hours sitting out on the tarmac at SeaTac while they replaced some component in the tail of the plane. I just can't do it anymore. It's a bit too stressful. So if I can't drive there or walk there or ride a bike there, I'm not going. Unless I could afford to hire a private plane or something like that. But
If you want to go to Chile, there's a cruise ship that docks at Valparaiso.
That just might be a good option.
Okay.
So, Fritz, you were on about 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about some new contacts that you've made with the Illuminati hierarchy. You've been communicating with William Van Dyne and with Jacob Rothschild. You know, these are people that are at the tip top of the Illuminati pyramid, so to speak. And so you had some bombshell news that we went over. We were talking about William Van Dyne, or at least his assistant had communicated to you that he was somewhat responsible for the deaths of the banksters that have been occurring this year. I've lost count. It was 15 or so.
Yes.
And that he said that he was bringing high-level criminals to justice through an outfit called the Bureau, which has 50 or so assassins. So after our show last week, I noticed that a link to our show got shared over to a Twitter account. It was a tweet from William Cornelis Van Dyne with a link to the show, and then that got shared over to his Facebook page. Do you think that's a legitimate account, or do you think it's somebody's?
Oh, yes. In fact, he asked me why I'm not using Twitter, and it's something that, you know, my response was, as you know, I was in prison for 8 years, and I just haven't really fully broadened my horizons into getting acclimated to using all of the social media. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I can talk with you or somebody. I need to talk with someone about Twitter so I feel more comfortable in using it.
I think with Twitter, for you, it would be useful if you were communicating to people when you had a new essay up on your Facebook page or on your blog, because you don't have a lot of room. You can't say too much, and you know, where on Facebook you could write a whole essay and throw it up there, and so it's just for I don't know, you've got just a few characters. How many characters are you allowed to have on a Twitter post? Something like, I don't know, 52 characters or something like that.
So why do people use it?
I don't even have a Twitter account.
I don't know. I don't use Twitter very often. Maybe I'm missing out on something. But, you know, and I use Facebook just for the news feed mostly and posts on our radio. But personally, you know, I don't do much at all on it. I don't share too much on it except complaints about the government. So one thing that we had talked about was you had asked them if they had any information about the assassination of JFK.
Yeah, and you know, I was very interested in that because I was in elementary school when it happened. A lot of the younger people, you know, even people that are a few years younger than me, the Kennedy assassination wasn't a trauma memory for them. The big trauma for them was 9/11. But for me, I've been curious about the details, the mechanics of the Kennedy assassination. So, yeah, I spent some time trying to understand that better. And I did get some feedback. But one of the things that I began to recognize is they are still touchy about the whole thing. They were less touchy about the Lincoln assassination. So I guess there's been enough time since Lincoln was killed that they feel more comfortable at people learning about it.
The Lincoln assassination was an Illuminati project?
Yeah, that, you know, and I have always contended that Lincoln was their candidate. I mean, it seemed to me real obvious that they had picked him as their candidate, and it was Lincoln being elected that caused the Civil War. I don't know if a lot of people are aware of that, but he was not on the ballot in any southern state. He did not get a single vote in the southern states because he wasn't even on the ballot. So imagine the entire South has a president that nobody voted for. And they're just like, this is outrageous. We're going to have to subject ourselves to this abolitionist who nobody even voted for. So ta-ta, goodbye. You know, we joined this union and we're leaving it. So his election caused the split between the North and the South, the secession. And that was something that the Illuminati wanted. They wanted to divide and conquer. They wanted to create a war where they could cause a lot of debt. That's what they use war for, is to make money and to put us into debt. The further into debt we go, the more we can be controlled, plus the more money they make. You know, so it's a win-win for them to create a war. And so that's what the Civil War was created for. And they expected that Lincoln was going to borrow gobs of money from them. And, you know, Lincoln turned out, even though he was the one that they wanted in, he had his own ideas, and he circumvented them and printed up his own money, just like JFK did. And, you know, both presidents decided, hey, I'm president. The U.S. government doesn't need to go to somebody like the Fed or the banksters and get their money. So both of them just printed up U.S. dollars and ticked the bankers off.
So you had an Illuminati organization around that time. What you're saying, this was a group of Freemasons. So what was the content? You know, who were the members around that time? Do you know? Have you done research going back that far?
You mean the membership within the Illuminati?
Yes.
Well, it was approximately the 13 bloodlines that I wrote about. Well, actually, my book has more than that. It has 15. Mm-hmm. The specific 13 top bloodlines has shifted over the years. You know, some are demoted, some are promoted. The Krupp family back then was one of the top 13. The Krupps were a German family, and the Krupps made most of the steel for our, you know, the wheels on our locomotives and railway cars. It had to be a high quality steel, and the Germans were the ones that were able to, the Krupps, I should say, mm-hmm. were the ones that were able to do that. So they were in business with the robber barons that created our railroads. And as you know, Lincoln was an attorney for these big railroad robber barons. And so, you know, it all kind of goes together. But yeah, even back then, the Rothschilds were right at the top, one of the inside top families. Mm-hmm. And they had a number of agents, Belmont, they had Benjamin, they had a number of agents in the United States, and they had front companies as well as banks. The Rothschilds started creating banks over in the United States in 1812, and the code word for their banks was Citi. You know, if it had Citi in the name of it, it was one of their banks. So, the Rothschilds, Van Dynes, were in the inner circle back then.
So where did the Rossiers take place?
Pardon me?
The Rossiers?
Don't know. How's that spelled?
It would be Rossier.
Yeah, I don't know about that family.
I was wondering if it was dispelled rumor or not.
So, Fritz, we'll get back to some American history in a few minutes here. Are there any other topics that you've been speaking to Van Dyne or Baron Rothschild about?
Oh, yeah, lots of topics. I've been touching on so many topics. You know, some of them turn out to be, they're sensitive about them, and others they will share with me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's up to them. They gave me some updates on the Bilderberg meetings, and then. One of the things that's come out, which relates to something you wanted to talk about, was, you know, and I have to get back with them and try to understand why, but this Arab investment company has been allowed to take over Deutsche Bank and Barclays, and I don't understand why that was allowed.
Oh, yes. I was asking if you had any information about Rothschild banks getting out of the fixing of the silver price.
Yeah. Well, see, in the past, the Rothschilds set the price of gold twice daily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the Rothschilds had the majority of the world's gold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the elite had most of the rest. And then they shifted where you had this like the Illuminati's banks, you know, sort of fronted for them setting the price of silver and gold. So you had Deutsche Bank, HSBC, and the Bank of Nova Scotia every day setting the price of gold and silver. And Deutsche Bank and HSBC are held by Blackwater? Was that the name of the holding company that they've got so many black this and that? So
Blackwater was the mercenary organization.
Okay, I'm getting the name mixed up there, but anyway, their holding company or their investment company that's located over in California, they control Deutsche Bank and HSBC. And then, as you know, and this tied in with that shooting in Aurora, you had that Lieber scandal. And, you know, after the Lieber scandal, then there was all this scrutiny about how rates are being fixed, whether the bullion rates were being manipulated or not. And,
well, you know, I researched, sorry to interrupt. I researched that, actually. The whole thing with the LIBOR scandal being tied to the shooters, Lanza and Holmes. And
right.
There was no truth to it. I actually, you know, there was this rumor that was flying around alternative media saying that Adam Lanza's father was going to testify before a Senate hearing about LIBOR. And you could go to the Senate's website. You could see, you know, what hearings are going on, who's been called to testify. And he wasn't on there. Holmes's father wasn't on there. They never did testify. I don't think they had any connection to it at all. I don't know how the rumor got started. And but I couldn't find any evidence that there was anything to it. And so I'm still trying to get the word out that was just disinformation that was trying to get people's tires spinning on something else. It was a distraction, and I'm not sure where it started, but the you know, I was trying to track the articles around, and I got it to I think it originated with a YouTuber named Fabian for Liberty. I used to follow him. And then it got out, into the Rents Network and, the Examiner, and then just started getting shared around after that. It was, but I just went to the Senate hearings website. There you go. It wasn't there.
Exactly. And I kind of suspected that. And that's why if you look at my post, I don't beat that drum real loud, is because, I was like you. I was like suspicious of that whole thing, but that's what they do. Or I mean, not what they do, but what the truth movement does is you get these people that just put out this. You know, you just wonder where does this stuff come from? Just like they pull it out of their something or others,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. So, but the Lieber scandal did cause a lot of scrutiny, and I don't know if that has something to do with why Deutsche Bank earlier this year said that they were going to back out of working with these two other banks to fix the price. And then this Qatar Investment Authority, which is, you know, all of their directors and everything are Arabs, they're buying a whole bunch of these, or, you know, are getting controlling stock in Deutsche Bank and Barclays and a number of these other traditional Illuminati banks and financial institutions. And one of the things that I want to do, and I haven't had time because I've been working on so many different issues, but I want to ask them, because I can only ask so much at a time, you know. Mm-hmm. I want to ask them why their, what have been traditionally their banks, are being turned over to the Arabs. And I'm wondering if it has something to do with Deutsche Bank getting out of fixing the price of silver and gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the deal with the silver fixing, what I think is happening is that they've done their damage to the price. We've talked about this on the show over and over again. You know, they've been engaged. The banksters have been engaging in naked short sales of silver and gold and driving the price down. And at the same time, the supply of physical metal has been going down and down and down. You know, it defies how any open market would operate. And so I figured that they've been manipulating the price through these naked short sales, these derivatives, and then buying physical metal on the cheap and stocking up on that. That's why the supply is drying up. So it'll look bad for them if they fix the silver price high so they can make their profit. It's easier if they just stop doing it and they let the market do it, because the market's going to price it up a lot. And then they could start selling their inventories if they want and make a pretty good profit. So that's my assessment. Chuck, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think that you have, that's a good possibility. Probably better than anyone I can think of. But it seems to me that if there is a, you know, one thing that might be wrong with it is just it's a little bit too simple and too easy to figure out.
Yeah.
That would be my only thing that would be. It doesn't mean they wouldn't do it, because people are so financially, I would say, illiterate these days. It doesn't take much to pull one over on them. Mm. So maybe, you know, that's about the best scenario that I've heard or could think of myself. They have to have still have some way to dispose of their naked shorts to resolve the loss they're going to take there against the profit they're going to make when they stop fixing the price low.
Right.
And the only thing I can think there, they're going to bundle them up into some kind of a junk status and sell them to somebody else and have someone else take the loss for them.
Yeah, because they could get hammered if the price starts moving up.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly how they're going to get rid of that, but I'm sure that they have a way that they figured out to do that to make it sound like it's appealing to people. They have people buy them out of their positions for pennies on the dollar, but then they're stuck with this ticking time bomb. I don't know.
For a bailout, perhaps.
I know whatever they're doing is probably illegal, and it's probably immoral, and they're probably going to get, I hope they get hung on their own rope, or with their own rope on that one. It's just, but, you know, silver and gold is moving up, and Bitcoin's moving up. It's I think we're seeing the beginning of some serious inflation coming on here. They're no longer able to suppress these prices.
So Fred, yes, but
go ahead.
Ultimately, if they're the ones that control like 95% of the gold or something, I don't see how the price of gold going up is going to hurt them in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I'm not sure they're the ones that are necessarily trying to keep it down. I think maybe governments are doing that, but their governments are running out of money to do it with. I know in the United States, it's really bad for them, for people to perceive there's inflation. And before, when they're doing all this quantitative easing there, and by suppressing the price of gold, that was the only place it was really showing, was the price of gold and silver were going up. Well, by driving those back down, then the inflation was expressed through a bubble in the stock market. But they just lie about that and say we're having a recovery, which isn't true. And so then people will just nod and accept that. So yeah, things are good. My life sucks, but everybody else is doing okay. You know, they don't understand. They just buy the lie. So I think that by running out of money to drive that price down with anymore, that, you know, that price is starting to go up now. That might be the thing that is the first signal that real inflation is coming. I know that, my food bill keeps going up.
Yes. I think everybody can relate to that.
Yeah. I think it's kind of incredible that the three things that aren't included in cost of living are food, energy, and housing. Probably the three things that most people put at the top of their priority list.
This feels actually like a good place to chime in for me. I'm sorry. But
go ahead, Colby.
To ask a question, are Arabian companies buying – is there an availability to buy stock in Blackwater for one?
Not Blackwater. I'm spacing off the name. Help me out here, Drew.
Blackwater is a contract company, which I think is a part of Halliburton.
No, I'm not talking about Blackwater. Yeah. I was talking about the holding company that, like I say, they've got a whole bunch of companies that start with black, and I'm spacing it off. I wrote about it several times, Drew. Do you remember what I wrote, the holding
company? Well, there's Black and Veatch, and...
Okay. We'll go on. I have these moments where I can't think of things. Anyway, going back to the Bilderberg meeting, the first one that they had back in 1954, where they adopted that silent weapons for quiet wars. Drew, you probably have talked about that or are familiar with that. Iron Mountain Report.
And you're talking about BlackRock, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, and as far as, you know, quiet wars go, they have all sorts of weapon systems that they're developing, you know, that aren't guns and bombs and whatnot. You know, they've got, you know, they have EMP weapons, and they've got microwave devices, you know, and Colby probably has a lot of info on that sort of thing.
I don't have a lot of info, but I could chime in. We have them on our SWAT weapons, but we don't have them on our militarized weapons. None of those things actually happen out of country that I've ever seen. They were actually on History Channel being shown as like a crowd control that was through a military unit, but we don't have them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So go ahead, Fritz. What was it you were getting into there?
Well, in this study, Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars, the Iron Mountain Report, what they were saying is that, you know, in the past they had used wars to control us, but they wanted to get away from shooting wars, mm-hmm. and they wanted to find alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
So alternatives to having a hot war was like, for instance, you know, we had the Cold War, we had the War on Terror, We had the war on drugs, and these were the kind of things that they talked about back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how familiar people are with the Iron Mountain Report, but if they're not, they should go back, because it's exactly what's happened since 1954 until now, is they've been implementing these things. And the control mechanisms, how they would do mass control on, mind control on us,
mm-hmm.
the whole nine yards, everything in there they've been doing. And in the past, when I've written my books, I haven't talked about it because I've not tried to cover ground that other people have already covered.
Sure.
But now that, you know, there's a whole number of things upon reflection, as I look back, you know, over 25 years, I realize I probably should have talked more about these things that other people brought to light, just because a lot of people haven't picked up on them yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So my post the other day was talking about that NASA war document, which...
Yeah, I was watching that video this morning.
What did you think?
Well, I've seen that document. A couple of years ago, I came across it.
Right.
And I remember browsing through it. I don't think I sat down and read the whole thing. It was bizarre, to say the least. And I don't even know if the document is still available. I'll try to find it and try to pull it up here. But I don't think it's still up there. But you had a post on your wall about that yesterday or today.
Right.
With a video.
Right.
That was linked in there.
Where Deborah Tavares talks about that NASA war document. She does a great job. And
it was about warfare in 2025 and the types of things that the military would be dealing with and things that have to be addressed, like cyborgs, robots,
mm-hmm.
space aliens, things like that. And this wasn't a joke.
No, it's exactly what my sources say are coming.
Let's get into this alien thing a little bit.
Okay.
I don't like to go down rabbit holes like this usually, but
me neither.
I just think Project Bluebeam. You know, when I think
yeah, me too.
Been planning to fight space aliens, I say yeah, I'm not buying that. It's a psyop, and you're just getting everybody ready for Project Bluebeam. And, you know, Bill Clinton talked about having a war with space aliens. I think I remember Ronald Reagan talking about having a war with space aliens to bring all the people of the world together. It seems like it is an ongoing theme, something that they'll probably roll out at some point.
Well, my sources say it's not going to be like that. It's not going to be a war against them. It's going to be them coming in to rescue us.
Oh.
And if you think about that, I mean, you know, if we get beat down with all these things that are coming down the road, people are just going to have the attitude, help from anywhere is help, you know. And they're just going to be grateful for help. And, you know... imagine a race of aliens coming along and saying, you know, we're much more evolved than you, and you're destroying yourself, and here we are, we've been there, done that, we know how to pull you out of these problems, and they rescue us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like you, Drew. I kind of feel like I'm a dinosaur in all of this because I'm just a little bit too mistrustful to trust that scenario.
Yeah, if that happens, I'm not buying it, and I'll try to debunk it. and if you really do see space aliens and they say they're aliens from another planet, they're probably demons. That's a whole other issue there. But just, you know, most of our listeners don't watch television, so I think there's a lot of people that are awake out there that will see things from a different perspective. It blows my mind whenever I see television. I don't watch TV. I don't have cable. Recently, I was at my in-laws, and they have the TV on all the time. And it was just a total culture shock. I'm like, whoa, this is what people around me are watching, and this is what people think is important? It was just a really, really strange. It felt like it was kind of like visiting another country.
Drew, there are people in our government that have been interacting with aliens that are thoroughly convinced that, you know, the aliens exist, the aliens are this and that. You know, we hear, you know, a back engineering alien technology. So there are plenty of people within our secret government structure that are fully convinced that these are aliens with superior technology.
Well, there's accounts of this sort of thing, you know, going way back in human history, and it depends upon the times, you know, whether they're talking about alien visitations or visitations from the underworld or whatever. It's a common theme in human history, and so. You have to wonder why this keeps coming up. You know, why there were hieroglyphs, you know, that showed pictures that looked like Apache helicopters. You know, things, mysterious things like that. And we might have lost Fritz there. His signal is going. We might have lost him. Fritz, can you hear me?
I think he's trying to get back on.
Yeah. He might be trying to get back on.
There he is.
There he is, Fritz. Okay. So, and it gets me thinking about, I've been researching the Book of Enoch lately. Are you familiar with that, Fritz? Fritz, can you hear me? I still don't think that we...
Yeah, I don't think he connected.
Yeah, I don't think he connected.
So...
I think what I might do is I'm going to drop him and then try to reconnect with him.
Well, to fill in between.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Can you hear us, Fritz? We can see you.
We can't hear you.
But you're having audio. Try turning your video feed off there. See if that changes things.
Well, drop him and add him again.
Okay. I'm gonna try to drop him and add him back in. Okay. Let's see if that helps.
Well, Drew, sorry, you guys, working with technical difficulties. We continue talking between Chuck and
yeah. Hey Colby, what do you think of the
alien part? This year I saw something that blew my mind. I saw it looked like a triangular three light thing out here with four of my neighbors, and you know, it was around Christmas time. I think we were having some drinks to celebrate, you know, New Year's / Christmas. And all of us were in shock, and it was moving simultaneously. And I've been in the military for 8 years before this. Never seen anything like it. And honestly, it blew my mind the way that it moved, the way it acted. And I've seen this in the past in my life in Oregon when I was a child. My mom and her best friend freaked out about this similar thing. So, is it government? Is it alien? I don't know, but I tell you, it's not something most of us have seen as technology.
Right. Well, there you go. If you ever run for office, that just messed up all your plans there.
Now, Drew, can you hear me?
Yeah. I don't know how that happened.
I wonder if I hit a sensitive subject, but... You know, back in 1897, there was a rash of UFOs, flying saucers. In World War II, the Americans, pilots or crews called them Foo Fighters. But the other side was also seeing them. Now, we know it's you know, been documented that the Nazis had flying saucers. But whether that accounts for what their pilots were seeing, I don't know. But yeah, like you say, this goes way back, and then we read something like Enoch, and it's created a lot of speculation as to whether there's been these watchers that have been interfering with human history.
Right. Yeah, and... The Book of Enoch, I mean, it goes way back. I mean, it's dated back to the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, if I recall correctly. I'm not an expert on this topic at all.
Well, yes, you're right.
You've probably studied in much more depth than I have. So explain to our listeners what the Book of Enoch is. You're not going to find it in your Bible, most likely.
No, there's actually different versions of it, but it was a book that wasn't canonized, but was used a lot by the early Christians. And like you say, it talks about these beings, and it talks about, you know, the genetic manipulation of the human race. And so it raises some questions. You know, if the book is correct, why it's a window into how the human race has been manipulated.
Right. And there are references to Enoch in the Old Testament,
and sure, in Jude,
sure, and so people at the time were aware of it. It very well could have been included in with the other books of the Bible. For some reason, it was not. But it does, you know, it covers the watchers, and, you know, and it goes along with the book of Genesis, and explains the Nephilim, and the men of old, the sons of the fallen angels who had children with human women. And mm-hmm. And they were, according to the Book of Genesis, they were giants. And
yeah, I'm pretty convinced that they have started a hybrid program where they're creating Nephilim. And
that and other things. There's so much genetic manipulation going on. I went to the pet store the other day, and they had glow-in-the-dark fish. they were GMO fish, and you could buy them for your kids. And they had little Danios that glowed green or purple or yellow or whatever. And it freaked me out. I realized that I was living in the future. I was like, wow, that's cool. And then I thought, that's wrong.
Yes.
Now, you shouldn't be messing around with God's software.
Well, I've had a couple of these super soldiers contact me over the years, and they were genetically modified people, and they felt like freaks, and they didn't like what had been done to create them. So, anyway, yeah, it's getting extreme, and people are playing God, and this is the direction that things are going. So, yeah, that what I posted that Deborah was saying, where she goes into that NASA war document, you know, that was right on. And but the thing that I'm wondering is with all of this negativity coming, we might end up getting rescued, you know, from it. And One of the things that I notice is in the past is the people that like to control, they like to set up scenarios which you're double-binded. Whichever way you go, they win, you know?
Yes, right. I was thinking about that as far as the Boko Haram thing goes. I saw a news article in the Facebook feed about sex slaves in Copenhagen, and you know, in the picture of the slaves, they looked like they could have been kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls, and it got me thinking whether or not Boko Haram was some sort of Illuminati project that served them in a couple of ways to get sex slaves to have some fun at Bilderberg and get Obama to move into Africa and get some things going there so that they could loot some more resources, start some more wars. And so you can see there's always some way where they benefit from both sides, you know, and people usually see things as black and white. But things aren't even shades of gray. They're swirled together.
Right.
There's a good way to look into this right now. It'd be with the gold buying and the ditching of the U.S. dollar. Me and Chuck talked about this a while back, a couple days ago. And so we've got the gold currency from China and Russia being taken. But then also, if you think about inflation and you think about actually decreasing inflation, how do you do that? You do it by decreasing the population. So if you think about, you can go all the way back to the Civil War with it, like he has said earlier in the show, and the one part that's never taken into effect is the amount of people that are buying goods versus how much money they have.
Yeah, population reduction is definitely on the agenda. They have not been bashful about, they've been upfront with me that they want at least half of the population taken out. And maybe last time we talked on the show, we may have talked about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So you'd made a reference to our being saved in some way. Are you talking about being saved by the aliens?
That's the impression I get that's in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are looking for an attack where the world's going to have to defend themselves. It's going to be the other way around. You know, so they're going to be pleasantly surprised.
Mm.
You know, one of the theories that kind of floats out there on the internet is that there's more than one race of aliens. And there's some that are trying to protect us, and there's others that are kind of looking to, you know, to rape the planet, take us, make us into something else, make us into food or something. I don't know. They don't have any good designs, anything that's good for us in mind. And there's another race that's protecting us from them. That's what I've heard. I guess there's a couple of videos on YouTube. I don't know how accurate that information is, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are contributing information, and I have typically, once I spent a few years investigating the whole thing, I just backed off and sort of put everything on the shelf, you know, sort of like it sounds you've done, it sounds like what you've done, Chuck.
Yeah, I mean, it seems very logical that there's one other race out there. There's probably more than one, but the fact that they're even worried about, you know, some primitive people on planet Earth way out in the middle of nowhere, it's kind of hard for me to believe that they would interact that closely with what our, you know, what's happening, our development and all that. But still, we may be closer to where things are happening than we know. I don't know.
Yeah. It's kind of an interesting concept to think that we may be a petri dish. We're just a bunch of experiments.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that have happened in history that seem, you know, especially related to the our nation's founding, that just seem like there are just accident after accident after accident that just seem to work out towards the, you know, the direction that the country was destined to take. You know, the Pilgrims being blown way off course and happening to land on the only part of the North American coastline that wasn't inhabited by a hostile tribe. And it was because the tribe that had lived there had all died of some mysterious disease a few years earlier. And so, you know, no one was there to, you know, drive them off the land. And they were able to establish a colony there. It's, you know, that's kind of serendipity, if you ask me.
Well, and beyond that, Chuck, it was more serendipitous than that. You had two natives that were fluent in English that came down.
Yes.
And helped them learn how to take care of themselves because they were starving and they didn't know beans from potatoes about how to grow crops and take care of themselves. So the Indians rescued them and allowed them to survive.
Yeah, one of them was Squanto. I don't remember the other one's name. It was
So Fritz, That goes back to your essay that you posted today called New World History.
I'm leaving all those mysteries for my readers to try to figure out.
Okay, no spoilers then.
Fritz, I love the stuff you wrote about the Roanoke colony, and that was very interesting. I'm going to do more research on that. That was fascinating.
Yeah, there's a whole nother level there. Yeah, I'm glad you appreciated it. There's a lot of these interesting things that escape our history books.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by the fact that people coming across these gray-eyed Indians that spoke Welsh.
Exactly. Exactly. What's that tell you?
Yeah,
that wasn't something that I wrote in the thing, but I'm glad you picked up on it. Mm-hmm. Here the settlers are coming there, and they're meeting people that are gray-eyed, kind of white-skinned, and speaking Welsh to them. Yeah. Go figure.
Yeah, so it's like, how'd this happen? And that's where some of those colonies must have disappeared to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, I don't know if we're going to go in this direction, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. You know, during the French and Indian War, the British were trying to get the people that were living on the edge of the Indian territory to kind of rise up against Indians and, or after that was over, excuse me, rise up against Indians, kind of push them back into more of another area where they would quiet them down and everything. But a lot of those people had actually gotten tired of living under the British rule and had gone to live with the Indians because they were a lot more libertarian and they just kind of let them do what they wanted to do. And they had as long as they would take care of themselves and not be a hindrance on the tribe, they were free and they enjoyed that lifestyle a lot better. And the English, when they'd ride up on these tribes and they'd see the, you know, a fellow Englishman there living with the Englands, with the Indians, they would get kind of upset with them and, you know, say, well, you know, you should be on our side, not on their side. And they'd just tell them, go fly a kite or something, you know, pound sand. I like it here.
And yes, that's a good point. When the white people came over, if you look at their charters, for instance, like Columbus, you'll see in the paperwork that's laying down the foundation for why his expedition comes over, they always say, you know, it's to Christianize the Indians, to bring them to Christ. And so that was a major goal, at least, you know, it was a major pretext for why the white people were coming over, was to bring civilization, to bring Christian values to the natives. And the thing was, is the Europeans couldn't separate their culture from Christ. So the Europeans, they wore these shoes that didn't feel comfortable, and the Indians wore moccasins that were comfortable. The clothes that the Europeans wore were extremely uncomfortable and hot and itchy, and the Indians wore little or very comfortable clothes. I'm just showing the trend here, that what you were saying is that the lifestyle of the natives was very libertarian and very easygoing, and there was this enormous exodus of white people that left the towns and cities and went native, and there were very few Indians that came over to the white side and Christianized, and the few that did would get disgusted and generally go back to the natives after being Christian for a while. So yeah, that's been covered up by history, but yeah, the trend was, unfortunately for the whites, instead of the Indians being interested in the white culture, it was the other way around, because the whites had been suppressed as serfs for so long. Once they saw real freedom, they took it.
Yeah, it was probably a much nicer lifestyle than what they've been accustomed to, someone telling them what to do all the time. Some of them may have been escaped indentured servants. Who knows?
Yes, exactly.
They just really preferred living in a freer life. that they had with the Indians. And so some of the people in those original colonies, maybe they kind of volunteered to join the Indians because it was, there was a 3 square meals a day, and they didn't have to subscribe to all this other stuff that was, you know, making them, you know, live this contrived life that they, you know, they're finding wasn't working out so well in the wilderness.
Exactly. Well, life was not easy in the English colonies. The lifespan of an indentured servant, which was a white slave, was not very long. I think they came over, help me out on this, Drew, the typical contract when an indentured servant came over was like 4 or 5 years. Am I correct there?
I think it was 7.
7, okay, yeah, okay, that's it. Yeah, it was 7 years.
Keep in mind that this wasn't straight up slavery, you know, even in a complete anarcho-capitalist libertarian utopia, you would still have indentured servitude if people agreed to enter into an agreement like that.
Yeah, well, basically they're paying their way over to, and they owe them 7 years of service to for their passage.
Right, but the thing is, Drew, if you look at the statistics, very few of those indentured servants lived through the 7 years of slavery. Yeah. Most of them died.
That's a bad deal.
So, yeah. It wasn't that good of a deal.
Well, almost half of the people that landed at Plymouth Rock died in the first 6 months.
Right.
And it was, they really were malnourished coming across the ocean. That was 2 months of not getting enough minerals and vitamins. And so they were severely malnourished by the time they landed, and didn't take much of a disease just to kill them. They'd catch a cold and that was it.
Yeah, and it brings out something that pertains to all of us, and that is, are we ready, are we as individuals ready to take responsibility for our lives? You know, I was Old Order Amish, as some of you may know. That was horse and buggy. They lived like in the 19th century, right? And they are extremely competent people. They know 1,001 tricks on how to deal with life successfully. So there was a group of Amish that decided, you know, that they didn't like living in the United States anymore. You can imagine they had plenty of good reasons to want to move. I mean, here's Chuck wanting to move, you know.
And so, that is the end of the show. Sorry to cut you off there, but you have to listen. Nope.